questions had been, are they trying to starve me to death, freeze me? Am I slowly losing my mind in this 12-by-12 cell, or losing it rapidly? Will I ever see my grandchildren? Do I want to? He liked the new questions better, troubling as they were. At least he would be able to walk down a street somewhere and breathe the air and feel the sun and perhaps stop at a cafe and sip a strong coffee. He'd had a client once, a wealthy cocaine importer who had been snared in a DEA sting. The client had been such a valuable catch that the feds offered him a new life with a new name and a new face if he would squeal on the Colombians. Squeal he did, and after surgery he was reborn on the north side of Chicago, where he ran a small bookshop. Joel had dropped in one day years later and found the client sporting a goatee, smoking a pipe, looking rather cerebral and earthy. He had a new wife and three stepchildren, and the Colombians never had a clue. It's a big world out there. Hiding is not that difficult. Joel closed his eyes, grew still, listened to the steady hum of the four engines, and tried to tell himself that wherever he was headed, he would not live like a man on the run. He would adapt. He would survive. He would not live in fear. There was a muted conversation underway two bunks down, two soldiers swapping stories about all the girls they'd had. He thought of Mo, the mob snitch who for the last 4 years had occupied the cell next to Joel's, and who, for about 22 hours a day, was the only human he could chat with. He couldn't see him, but they could hear each other through a vent. Mo didn't miss his family, his friends, his neighborhood, or food or drink or sunshine. All Mo talked about was sex. He told long, elaborate stories about his escapades. He told jokes, some of the dirtiest Joel had ever heard. He even wrote poems about old lovers and orgies and fantasies. He wouldn't miss Mo and his imagination. Unwillingly, he dozed off again. Colonel Gantner was shaking him, whispering loudly, "Major Herzog, Major Herzog, we need to talk." Backman squeezed out of his bunk and followed the colonel along the dark, cramped aisle between the bunks and into a small room, somewhere closer to the cockpit. "Take a seat," Gantner said. They huddled over a small metal table. Gantner was holding a file. "Here's the deal," he began. "We land in about an hour. The plan is for you to be sick, so sick that an ambulance from the base hospital will meet the plane at the landing field. The Italian authorities will do their usual quick inspection of the paperwork, and they might actually take a look at you. Probably not. We'll be at a U.S. military base, and soldiers come and go all the time. I have a passport for you. I'll do the talking with the Italians. Then you'll be taken by ambulance to the hospital." "Italians?" "Yes. Ever hear of the Aviano Air Base?" "No, didn't think so. It's been around in U.S. hands since we ran the Germans off in 1945. It's in the northeast part of Italy, near the Alps." "Sounds lovely." "It's okay, but it's a base." "How long will I be there?" "That's not my decision. My job is to get you from this airplane to the base hospital. There, someone else takes over. Take a look at this bio for Major Herzog, just in case." Joel spent a few minutes reading the fictional history of Major Herzog and memorizing the details on the fake passport. "Remember, you're very ill and sedated," Gantner said. "Just pretend you're in a coma." "I've been in one for 6 years. Would you like some coffee?" "What time is it where we're going?" Gantner looked at his watch and did a quick calculation. "We should land around 1 a.m. "I'd love some coffee." Gantner gave him a paper cup and thermos and disappeared. After two cups, Joel felt the engines reduce power. He returned to his bunk and tried to close his eyes. As the C-130 rolled to a stop, an Air Force ambulance backed itself close to the rear hatch. The troops ambled off, most still half asleep. A stretcher carrying Major Herzog rolled down the gateway and was carefully lifted into the ambulance. The nearest Italian official was sitting inside a U.S. military jeep, watching things half-heartedly and trying to stay warm. The ambulance pulled away in no particular hurry, and 5 minutes later Major Herzog was rolled into the small base hospital and tucked away in a tiny room on the second floor, where two military policemen guarded his door. Chapter 4. Fortunately for Bachman, though he had no way of knowing and no reason to care, at the 11th hour President Morgan also pardoned an aging billionaire who had escaped prison by fleeing the country. The billionaire, an immigrant from some Slavic state who had had the option of redoing his name upon his arrival decades earlier, had chosen in his youth the title of Duke Mongo. The Duke had given trainloads of money to Morgan's presidential campaign. When it was revealed that he had spent his career evading taxes, it was also revealed he had spent several nights in the Lincoln bedroom, where over a friendly nightcap, he and the president discussed pending indictments. According to the third person present for the nightcap, a young tart who was currently serving as the Duke's fifth wife, the president promised to throw his weight around over at the IRS and call off the dogs. Didn't happen. The indictment was 38 pages long, and before it rolled off the printer, the billionaire, minus wife number 5, took up residence in Uruguay, where he thumbed his nose north while living in a palace with soon-to-be wife number 6. Now he wanted to come home so he could die with dignity, die as a real patriot, and be buried on his thoroughbred farm just outside Lexington, Kentucky. Kritz cut the deal, and minutes after signing the pardon for Joel Bachman, President Morgan granted complete clemency to Duke Mongo. It took a day for the news to leak. The pardons, for good reason, were not publicized by the White House, and the press went insane. Here was a man who cheated the federal government out of $600 million over a 20-year period, a crook who deserved to be locked away forever, and he was about to fly home in his mammoth jet and spend his final days in obscene luxury. The Bachman story, sensational as it was, now had serious competition from not only the kidnapped Danish tourists, but also the country's largest tax cheater. But it was still a hot item. Most of the major morning papers along the East Coast ran a picture of the broker somewhere on the front page. Most ran long stories about his scandal, his guilty plea, and now his pardon. Carl Pratt read them all online in a huge, messy office he kept above his garage in Northwest Washington. He used the place to hide, to stay away from the wars that raged within his firm, to avoid the partners he couldn't stand. He could drink there, and no one would care. He could throw things and curse at the walls and do whatever he damn well pleased because it was his sanctuary. The Bachman file was in a large cardboard storage box, one he kept hidden in a closet. Now it was on a work table, and Pratt was going through it for the first time in many years. He had saved everything. News articles, photos, interoffice memos, sensitive notes he'd taken, copies of the indictments, J.C. Hubbard's autopsy report. What a miserable history. In January of 1996, three young Pakistani computer scientists made an astounding discovery. Working in a hot, cramped flat on the top floor of an apartment building on the outskirts of Karachi, the three linked together a series of Hewlett-Packard computers they had purchased online with a government grant. Their new supercomputer was then wired to a sophisticated military satellite telephone, one also provided by the government. The entire operation was secret and funded off the books by the military. Their objective was simple: to locate and then try to access a new Indian spy satellite hovering 300 miles above Pakistan. If they successfully tapped into the satellite, then they hoped to monitor its surveillance. A secondary dream was to try to manipulate it. The stolen intelligence was at first exciting, then proved to be virtually useless. The new Indian eyes were doing much the same thing the old ones had been doing for 10 years, taking thousands of photographs of the same military installations. Pakistani satellites had been sending back photos of Indian army bases and troop movements for the same 10 years. The two countries